Hello, this is George McDonough, the executive producer of Power Corrupts. Brian's decided not to run ads this season, but he's told me that we'll be forced to get into money laundering if I don't read this for him. And he's also said that it would sound more sophisticated with my accent, particularly for the Americans listening. So here goes. You can help keep Power Corrupts going and editorial independent in a couple of ways. Firstly, by supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/powercorrupts. By joining our exclusive community, you'll get access to uncut interviews, episodes early, as well as bonus episodes later this season. And secondly, by pre-ordering Brian's new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. Brian interviews some extraordinarily weird people and brings out cutting-edge research from a variety of disciplines while answering questions which you've never thought about. Like, why do narcissists make more money? Why do our faces have so much to do with who gets power? Why are powerful monkeys in a hierarchy less likely to get hooked on drugs? And what's it like to take a ski lesson from a man who once ruled Iraq? If you like this podcast, you'll love the book. Thanks for listening and for your support.
Mr. Escobar was gunned down yesterday, and Colombian authorities say its message to other drug lords is to surrender or you will be killed. An elite Colombian police unit killed Pablo Escobar in a shootout, cornering him here in this house where he had been hiding in the city of Medellin.
The Libyan leader, bloodied and beaten, dragged alive through the streets after being caught in a drain. The irony of his hiding place not lost on those Gaddafi described as rats for rising up against him. This gold-plated gun, apparently taken from the deposed despot moments before he was killed.
The long road that led Chapo Guzman from the mountains of Sinaloa to the courthouse behind us today was paved with death, drugs, and destruction. But it ended today with justice. Mr. Guzman thought for more than 25 years that he was untouchable, that there was no problem affecting the Sinaloa cartel, that he couldn't bribe, intimidate, torture, or kill his way out of.
Today we're going to grapple with a question that makes me deeply uncomfortable. And that's because I'm going to argue in favor of a policy that I think is fundamentally unjust. What we'll be asking today is, can doing the wrong thing ever be the right strategy? We're going to start somewhat unexpectedly with Greek mythology and the parable of Icarus. He's the son of Daedalus, a master craftsman who makes wings out of wax, allowing Icarus to fly. But his father warned him, don't fly too low, lest the spray from the sea ruins the wings, or too high, lest the heat from the sun causes them to melt. But Icarus can't resist. Despite the warning, he flies higher and higher, as though he just wants to see how close he can get, how long he can bask in the heat. Eventually, the wings melt. Icarus crashes into the sea and drowns. For my entire career as a social scientist, I've studied people who behaved badly, and often got obscenely rich in the process. Whether it's drug kingpins or dictators, many of them started from humble backgrounds. The rank-and-file soldier who came to the palace in a perfectly executed coup, or the ambitious young man who rose from poverty in Medellin and thought he could take on the world. When confronted with these individuals who are driven by greed or by a seemingly unquenchable thirst for power, there was always a question that lingered with me. Why don't they ever quit while they're ahead? Once you've got $1 billion, why not just leave? Why not take the money and run? After all, you can't enjoy your grotesque wealth if you're dead. But still, like Icarus, they seem to not be able to resist flying ever higher, breaking into that new drug market, capturing that last shred of power that previously eluded them, until they get too close to the sun, which is when they lose everything. In this episode, we're going to understand why that happens. And what I'm going to try to convince you of is somewhat surprising, that a lot of that Icarus-style behavior is actually perfectly rational and reasonable. But I'm also going to try to convince you of something else, that sometimes the best thing to do is to let kingpins and despots get away with it. Thank you. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. We're going to start in the world of drug trafficking, a world of kingpins and cartels, to figure out the answer to a simple question with a complex explanation.
Why people stay in the drug trafficking world, the cartel world, even when they have a bunch of money, and those of us who are outside that culture think, you know, why don't they just leave that? And you made a couple of million dollars. You know, why aren't you living in like Italy somewhere, just, you know, hiding out?
That's Yoan Grillo, a freelance journalist who has been the go-to guy for covering the illicit world of drug smuggling and cartels, particularly in Latin America. His latest book is called Blood, Gun, Money: How America Arms Gangs and Cartels, which I highly recommend, by the way. Yoan has an up-close understanding of drug networks that is rare for those who operate outside the cartel. And he started by telling me about the ways in which cocaine kingpins might have to make unusual adjustments in order to just do simple things like going to a restaurant with your fellow outlaws.
There's a rumor that goes around Mexico that a lot of people have heard or tell that, you know, you're in a restaurant and the drug trafficker comes in and it tells everybody, look, you know me, I'm going to take all your cell phones off your hands and then I'm going to pay everybody's bill at the end. I've heard a lot of people talk about that. It's hard to find someone who's really lived that.
The idea, of course, is that these guys are striking an implicit bargain with the people eating in the restaurant. You don't get to take our photo or to call the cops or to snitch on us. And in exchange, you eat for free. Other times, as Yoan saw firsthand, some of these guys behaved a bit more recklessly and just threw caution to the wind.
I was in recently in an ex-hacienda in Morelos, and I was there for a holiday. It was Sunday, and suddenly they see this really expensive car driving up. And then another one, I was like, oh, great, it's like some kind of car club, like really expensive, I mean, you know, like Lamborghinis kind of thing. Yeah. And there was like about 10 of these really expensive cars. People got out of the car, it was like, oh my God, and here we go, a bunch of like really dodgy looking people. Bunch of the wives with fake boobs, guys in tattoos and baseball caps, and you know, I was, you know, wondering if I knew anybody from police photos. They all sat down in a certain part of the restaurant, or kind of a certain room they had, and sat down. I was kind of tempted to kind of mosey over and start chatting and finding out more, but I thought, you know, best not in this case. And they, you know, they went off and they had their kind of part of the restaurant and paid the bill and left. I think that's a lot of the time how you might see these guys moving around.
No matter how much you invest in your protection racket, no matter how much you try to embed cartel people within the police, no matter how many bribes you pay, that sort of brazen behavior can only last for so long before you get killed or captured in the drug business. But rather than cashing out and leaving, most of these cartel guys do stick around until they're killed and captured. So why is that?
And I can think of three main reasons for this. One reason is for cartel people, once you're involved in many organizations, in many networks, you're not allowed to leave. They don't want people leaving because they have too much knowledge. This is particularly a threat on lower down people. You know, once you've been recruited and you've carried out contract murders, you've delivered money, you've seen mechanisms, then they know too much in terms of who's being bribed, where drugs are being stashed, who's laundering money, all of these things. So they don't want that person suddenly walking away and saying, okay, I'm just going to do a regular job now. The best thing to do is just to, like, you know, to run, because there's no retirement plan built into it. There's no, like, my contract's finished and I can leave.
Okay, so that makes sense for the lower level guys. But what about someone like Escobar or El Chapo?
The second is the money, the debts. And when I was in the mountains of Sinaloa in the village of El Chapo talking to his cousin, he was explaining this to me, that although drug traffickers make a lot of money, they spend a lot of money. They're always owing money to people, as well as money coming in. First of all, you have many, many chains in the drug trafficking. Sometimes I looked at things and counted the number of links in the chain, and I saw things like 6 links, can be more. But what I mean is you have a producer, you have a trafficker, moving large amounts. You have a sale down. So often you have, you know, you might have a warehouse or, you know, a big distributor in the United States linked to a cartel with tons of heroin. And then you sell to a more of a mid-level guy who's buying 100 kilos at a time, selling them down. And then there's somebody else who's like buying tens of kilos at a time. So you have a lot of links in the chain and a lot of money going away in all these different links. And then the drug traffickers themselves in Mexico are spending money on all kinds of things. They're paying police officers, they're paying judges, they're paying politicians, hitmen, spies, loads of people that they're throwing money to who are working for them.
If El Chapo just decided to throw in the towel, to take his massive pile of cash and retire, those pipelines of money would dry up, and a lot of people who had come to rely on that cash flow just wouldn't accept his retirement.
It's hard to get out because you've always still got to make some more money to pay back some money to pay people. It's not as easy. You can just walk away from this stuff without leaving debts to very violent people. And the way that debts are enforced in this world is through violence and extreme violence.
But let's say, just for the sake of argument, that you do manage to pay off all your debts. Even then, there's still another issue.
Where do these guys go? You know, where is El Chapo going to go? Where is this drug trafficker La Tuta going to go? Where are they going to hide out? And in so many occasions, they're hiding in plain sight where they're from, where they grew up, you know, right there in their environment. Often they'll go to the mountains, and some of them are country people who know the mountains, who know the countryside. And it is a place you can evade law enforcement in the Mexican countryside, in the Mexican mountains. You have dirt roads. You have a lot of people who are giving information. So if there's any movement of military or police, then you can, you know, move quickly. And you have all these villages connected by these dirt roads up in the mountains, these whole networks. And they're also kings in these areas. So one of the paradoxes is, although they can be very powerful and very rich, that their worlds are quite small in some ways.
Yoan got a glimpse of that when speaking to one of Pablo Escobar's family members, who didn't exactly paint a picture of a glamorous life during his childhood.
I interviewed his son last year, and he said that actually, for a lot of the time when he was a bit older, when his father was murdered in 1993 and he was 17, and in the couple of years before then, when his father escaped the prison that he kind of got built, the cathedral, that he said that they were not living well because they were always looking over their shoulder and moving from house to house, and you're not actually enjoying the money in the late years of life there.
And when it all catches up to you, it's often your family that pays the bills.
He said that after his father was killed and they had to get all his money together to pay off various other drug traffickers who were demanding money, and they got together selling everything and moving everything, about $220 million. That sounds reasonable, I think, in what the actual assets that a lot of these drug traffickers have is more like hundreds of millions.
The point, though, is that it's not difficult to see how rich people who make their money in illicit ways are actually constrained, not just in how they behave in restaurants, but in every aspect of their lives. And the biggest constraint of all is that they might not have a good exit option if they decide they want to get out of the criminal underworld and just enjoy their riches. Now, this isn't to convince you of the plight of murderous villains like Pablo Escobar or El Chapo, who committed heinous atrocities and killed and tortured hundreds of people. But it is useful to underscore the logic that for some of these people, the seemingly rational thing to do is to just keep going, even if you know that the way it's likely to end for you is in a casket or in a jail cell that's only a bit larger than a casket. Where things get interesting and morally complex is when we use that same logic and ask those same questions, like, why don't you quit while you're ahead? But we ask those questions to dictators rather than to drug dealers. And there's an even bigger question here. How do you get corrupt, murderous dictators to leave power when they're quite content to just stay in their gilded palace forever?
It makes no difference in terms of geography or ideology. Almost every president I've ever met anywhere on the planet, if they had their druthers, would have stayed president for life. When you think about it, even in a democratic context, the amount of ego, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but the amount of ego to conclude that in the case of the United States, out of 300 million people, you are the only one that can lead the country is a bit much when you think about it in that way. And most of the guys that I know have known who've occupied the presidency in the U.S., if they had their druthers, would have stayed in office beyond the two-term limit. So first of all, you kind of start with human nature.
That's Charles Stith, a former American diplomat, the chairman of the Pula Group, and the non-executive chairman of the African Presidential Leadership Center. And he and I sort of came up with a similar idea independently of each other, which we'll come back to in a moment.
Look, it's messy. It can rub you the wrong way in terms of your moral sensitivities. But, you know, we've done it and made it work in the past.
But first, we're going to go to a little sliver of a country in West Africa, nestled fully inside Senegal. I'm talking about the Gambia. We covered the former dictator's corruption in season one, on the episode about heists. So if you're interested in his regime, go back and listen to that one. But for our purposes, suffice to say that Gambia's tyrant, a man named Yahya Jammeh, was a ruthless, brutal dictator.
Welcome to the Gambia, land of sun, sea, sand, and a president who claims he can cure AIDS.
I get rid of the virus from the body of the human being, and that's what I do.
That's from a 2007 Al Jazeera documentary about Jammeh. In the video, there's an inadvertently chilling moment in which Jammeh rubs a gray sludge from an old Evian water bottle onto an HIV-positive patient that he claims to be a miracle cure that he invented himself. Then, with the cameras broadcasting live to Gambian national TV, Jammeh asks the patient whether the pain has gone or if it's still there. The poor man insists that the pain has suddenly miraculously disappeared, adding a sir for good measure. After all, what else can he do? We're talking about a dictator who murders his enemies without a second thought.
How's it?
It's better.
It's gone or it's still there?
It's gone.
Tell me the truth.
Gone. Yes, I'm telling you the truth, sir.
It's gone or it's still there?
It's gone.
In one truly bizarre speech, Jammeh pledged that he would rule the tiny country for 1 billion years. He lost power in 2016, so he only made it 22 years. And if you do the math, that's 1/45 millionth of his stated target. So he's sort of a failure on that metric, if I'm being honest. But in all seriousness, life under Jammeh was extremely oppressive. And that's why many people were forced to flee. Many people, including Sheriff Bojang Jr., a Gambian journalist and the president of the Gambian Press Union, who told me what it was like to try to report the news during Jammeh's dictatorship.
You had some of us during that time, Jammeh's time as journalists, we lived with fear. There was a roof of insecurity and fear hanging over every journalist's head. There was no safe journalism. You know, you could just get up in the morning planning to go to work and you leave your house never to return. Journalists were systematically arrested in the hands of state security. Journalists were tortured. Journalists were kidnapped. Journalists disappeared. State-sponsored disappearances were common. It was very dangerous. It was risky. It was challenging for the entire duration of the Jammeh presidency. And this is what we had to live with.
For our purposes, suffice to say, Jammeh was a tyrant. As you'll understand in a moment, it's important that I don't sugarcoat this. We shouldn't be under any illusions that this guy was in any way okay. He committed atrocities, including countless murders. And it seemed like he was never going to lose power, that his grip on his throne was tighter than ever, as he headed toward the elections in 2016.
So until a week before that 2016 election, if anybody had told me, and people told me, that there were chances that this is the end of the Jammeh regime, but I always said, nah. I mean, people, it's just a wishful thinking. People want to believe in what they want to believe in. It was impossible. I never dreamt for once that there was chance that Jammeh would lose the election.
The Gambia, by the way, used to vote in quite an unusual way. When voters arrived to cast their ballot, there were no ballots. Instead, there were multicolored drums, color-coded for each candidate. Each voter is then able to put a marble into the drum of their choice. When a marble goes into the drum, a little bell rings, which makes it easier to tell if someone smuggled in some extra marbles and tried to vote more than once. It gave fresh electoral meaning to the notion that this one is for all the marbles. And as the election got closer, Sheriff Bojang Jr. watched with trepidation as the opposition movement got bolder, and Jammeh cracked down on them, which only further galvanized the opposition.
This became like the point of no return for Gambians. Then everybody, those who were not active in politics, who wouldn't vote, who didn't care what was happening in the country, this was the moment they sat down and say, enough is enough. Now it is time for change.
As voters were waiting to cast their marbles, Jamie Yaya Berry, a former reporter for the New York Times based in West Africa, was covering the Gambian election. And he also sensed that change could be coming, because people were more openly denouncing a man who had previously been universally feared. But in the run-up to the election, Jamie just happened to cross paths with a guy from Liberia in a restaurant, who heard Jamie's friend speaking Creole from Sierra Leone, the local dialect. Recognizing that they were both foreigners in the Gambia who had come from the same part of the world, this Liberian guy gave them a stark warning. You should leave the country around the elections. It won't be safe. Jamie's interest perked up. His journalistic instincts were intrigued by this warning. The mystery Liberian man told Jamie that he had been a former child soldier in Liberia, but was now working as a mercenary. And here was the bombshell. He said that he had been hired by Yahya Jammeh, the dictator, quote, in case anything goes wrong around the election. So later that day, Jamie decided to meet up again with this guy, graciously accepting an invitation to attend a house party with other Liberians who were also in the Gambia. And when Jamie got there, the place was a complete dump, littered with mattresses and rotting food.
But the atmosphere inside, it was crazy because even the mattresses, they have like few mattresses on the floor. There was food waste, like they probably they've already eaten them, but then the plates were not cleared, it was on the floor and it was just dirty, you know. And they were just there having a good time and waiting to do whatever they were hired to do.
And that's when Jamie noticed the weapons and the drugs.
And then there were machetes, there were guns there, and there was a table in the middle with cocaine. And then it was this huge smell of marijuana. So then I walked in, and when I walked in, I coughed, and then I tried to hold my breath, and then my friend just hit me with his elbow like this, and so the guy said, oh, come in, come in, come in.
When Jamie walked in, one of the apparent mercenaries, a man who had been listening to music while snorting cocaine, took off his headphones and started questioning Jamie. He was fixated on the notebook that Jamie had sticking out of his back pocket, a notebook that Jamie had been using while doing reporting earlier in the day. And so he started grilling Jamie. Rather than trying to lie to a bunch of coked-up guys with machetes, Jamie decided the best course of action was just to tell the truth.
And I said, I'm a journalist, and everything just went dead for a few seconds. And then the guy now turned over to me and said, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me you're a journalist? I said, well, you didn't ask. But the thing is, don't worry, let's just talk. I just want to know what you're doing, and I'm not going to write about it. He said, sure. So we sat there and they were taking drugs and cocaine. And he said they were just waiting for if something goes wrong.
Jamie has never written about this or, as far as I can tell, told anyone in the press about this accidental encounter with mercenaries. Mercenaries hired by Yahya Jammeh in case something goes wrong with the election. Meaning, quite clearly, that in case Jammeh lost, they would have a contingency plan. But this encounter is hugely important for our story, especially in light of what came next.
And to news on the continent, businessman Adama Barrow was declared president-elect of the Gambia on Friday, ending over two decades of rule by Yahya Jammeh, a feared authority.
In a shock result, Jammeh lost. The people had ousted the dictator one marble at a time. And perhaps even more shocking was that Jemme accepted the result immediately. He called a press conference, and with the cameras rolling, he called up his opponent, Adama Barrow, to congratulate him.
I'm calling you to wish you all the best. The Gambian people have spoken, and I have no reason to contest the will of the Almighty Allah. The country will be in your hands in January. You are the elected president of the Gambia. I have no ill will, and I wish you all the best.
Jemme conceded defeat and even offered to help the president-elect, Adama Barrow, and even said that, you know, he was going to stay in the country and he was going home to his home village of Kanilai, his popular home village, and he was going to go back as a farmer and live his life as a normal citizen and then a farmer in his place. There was a lot of banter and goodwill. That phone call between Adama Barrow, the president-elect, and Jemme, the then outgoing president.
Take it from me as someone who studies dictatorships. This almost never happens. In fact, there's even something called the Mo Ibrahim Prize, which awards $5 million in cash to any African president who peacefully leaves power, either after an election defeat or after respecting presidential term limits. The prize has been around for 14 years, and in 8 of the 14 years, nobody qualified. It went completely unawarded. And that's partly because, as Charles Stith explains, $5 million is peanuts compared to what these presidents would be able to steal while they're in power.
When it comes to trying to get people out of office who were not elected by democratic means and who maintain power by undemocratic means, you've got a different set of challenges. If somebody has the national treasure as their personal piggy bank, it's pretty hard to make them a financial offer they can't refuse, right?
So when Yahya Jemme just straight up conceded defeat and volunteered to leave office peacefully, it seemed too good to be true. And that's because it was.
Exactly 1 week, the following Friday, first it started with the state broadcaster, that was the mouthpiece of Jemme, the Gambia Radio and Television Service, ran an announcement, an alert, that Jemme was going to make a speech. Then people were like, what speech? He was going to make a statement, he was coming live shortly, and then everybody went quiet, like, of course, naturally, wondering what he was going to say.
Days after conceding defeat in his country's election, Gambia's president is now demanding voters go back to the polls.
I hereby announce to you Gambians my total rejection of the electoral results, and thereby annulling the elections in its entirety.
Here's what happened. Jemme thought that he could just leave power peacefully, head back to his village, retire from public life, and enjoy a fabulous life of an elder statesman. But an elder statesman who had $1 billion that he stole from the Gambian people. He figured he could enjoy the riches that he'd gained from obscene corruption, and that nobody would bother him. Then, after he lost the election, word started to spread that he could face prosecution, and that the new president would consider seizing his illicit assets, returning them to their rightful owners, the Gambian people. Jemme had to come to grips with an even more horrifying thought. He could even lose his precious fleet of flashy sports cars. And that's when Jemme decided to reject the results, which caused plenty of uproar from the public.
The rule of democracy is you lose the election, you leave. You have no choice. You lose, you go. Whatever happens.
But Jemme wasn't willing to go. And this looming showdown raised a deeply uncomfortable question.
How many people were going to die with him? At what cost would he be forced to leave?
Of course, nobody knew that Jemme apparently also had a backup plan in the form of Liberian mercenaries who were already well-armed and were waiting for orders in the capital city. But it wasn't hard to imagine that bloodshed could soon follow. As Jemme started to call for the arrest of his opponents, and the mercenaries waited in their cocaine and machete-filled makeshift barracks, ECOWAS, a regional bloc of West African states, decided to just enforce the election results, by force if necessary. Here's another report from Al Jazeera back in 2016.
West African countries are threatening military intervention to remove Jemme if he does not step down. Soldiers from five nations are on standby, including Nigeria, which has moved a naval ship and fighter jets closer to the Gambia.
Jammeh finally began to recognize that his days in power might be numbered, so he tried to buy more time.
He was ordering his men, his officials, to withdraw money, and they were withdrawing money from the central bank and elsewhere, and he was taking this money out.
It's unclear what negotiations went on behind the scenes, but ECOWAS used both the carrot and the stick. While they publicly threatened to invade the tiny nation to remove Jammeh by force, they clearly made some sort of backroom deal with him at the same time, because Yahya Jammeh turned up at the airport in his Rolls Royce, an obscenely expensive car that had custom stitching on the headrest which read, "His Excellency Sheikh Professor Al-Haji, Dr. Yahya A. J. J. Jammeh." There were reports that a cargo plane had already left the airport with 22 other luxury vehicles. And one diplomat reported that 10 more luxury cars were being loaded onto another plane at the airport, along with suitcases full of cash. Jamie Yahya Berry was there to watch the spectacle unfold.
I was standing behind a female military officer, and so when Jammeh went into the flight, and then the flight took off, and the sooner the flight took off, it was like around 10 p.m. at night, it was already dark. The sooner the flight took off, this female officer dropped her gun, she turned towards me, and she just hugged me and began to cry.
Yahya Jammeh fled into exile into another brutal dictatorship nearby, in Equatorial Guinea. He took his flashy cars, undisclosed millions in cash, diamonds, and gold. Jamie and his New York Times colleagues interviewed a young woman named Fatima Cisse, a 24-year-old seamstress, about Jammeh's departure. And here's what she said. Yahya Jammeh came to power with nothing. Everything he has, he stole from Gambians. They should not let him take anything with him apart from his clothes to put on. He's a big thief. This young seamstress was certainly right. And he wasn't just a thief either. He was a murderer, a tyrant, a ruthless despot who held his country hostage for more than two decades. So what's the lesson here? We've arrived at the part of the episode where I advocate for a policy that I believe to be fundamentally unjust. I think, and I have to hold my nose when I say this, that what happened in the Gambia was probably more or less the best possible outcome. In a fully just world, Yahya Jammeh would be captured, his embezzled millions returned, his cars sold to help pay for economic development in his impoverished country, his flowing white robes replaced with an orange jumpsuit, his lavish living arrangement in Equatorial Guinea replaced by a grim, barren prison cell. But we don't live in a fully just world. And I worry that the attempt to bring Jammeh to justice, to prosecute him or to seize his riches, would have resulted in extreme bloodshed, a civil war fueled by mercenary armies. And at the end of that conflict, Jammeh would quite possibly have won, tightening his grip on power and holding the Gambian people hostage for another two decades. Sheriff Bojang Jr., a journalist who can now operate freely in his own country, also says that he feared that a prosecution could have led to an acquittal because of how Jammeh structured his orders, always leaving one level of separation between himself and his most ruthless henchmen.
My concern and my fear is you put Jammeh before any court of law. Honest and impartial international court of law today, you would struggle. I'm not a legal luminary, but then my observation is that you might struggle to get him convicted for anything. There was never anybody who said at the Truth Commission that Jammeh personally told them go and kill. There is always two people between them and Jammeh. You know, Jammeh would apparently or probably or allegedly told somebody, and that person would also told somebody, like gave order to somebody, and this one would give order to somebody, and then the third one would tell this jungler, this henchman, go and kill. Let's go and kill. So there is always two people between the killers and Jammeh himself when it comes to orders.
Dictators exist in a separate category to pretty much every other kind of person who goes before a criminal justice system. Because getting rid of a dictator changes everything. When you catch a serial killer, the system doesn't change. There's just one less dangerous criminal prowling the streets. When you bust a crooked politician in a democracy, you just take someone down who wasn't playing by the rules and you put them behind bars. But when you bring down a dictator, it's the rules themselves that change. The dictator is the system. And that means that getting rid of one individual can sometimes mean that literally everything changes. The entire system can transform virtually overnight. And if the transition is managed well, it can even have an intergenerational effect. The life chances for children and grandchildren of people who are liberated can radically change for the better. Of course, there's no guarantee that the Gambia will prosper. Adama Barrow, Yahya Jammeh's successor, is a deeply imperfect ruler. But Gambians at least now have a fighting chance to write a new chapter in their history. And that raises an uncomfortable possibility, that letting some despots escape justice in exchange for handing over the keys to the palace could, at least in some cases, be worth it.
When others start becoming dictators, they eventually will just continue to become even more brutal and more fierce to the extent that they want to stay in power until they die because they're worried about what will happen to them when they leave power. They become worse over the years. And once they become worse over the years, it's either they prefer to die in power and to have more people die with them, or you give them what they want and then they leave.
I mean, in a perfect world, you know, people who do the kinds of things that these folks did would receive their just desserts. But you make a trade-off. It's a shame, but do we allow many thousands more to die? Or do we try to figure out a way to proverbially cut our losses and hopefully move on to a better day?
In a book called The Despot's Accomplice that I wrote 5 years ago, before Jammeh left power, I argued for a policy that I called the golden handcuffs approach to getting dictators out of office. It's a term that riffs off the idea of a golden parachute, a large cash payment that is often given to CEOs or other senior figures in a company to basically get them to leave, but to leave with a cushy landing. I prefer the idea of golden handcuffs with dictators, a flexible system of ushering them out of power, depending on what is likely to be the most effective approach and the most just in a given circumstance. And by the way, I would never advocate for this approach for the worst of the worst tyrants, people like Bashar al-Assad in Syria or Kim Jong-un in North Korea. But in some cases, a little bit of flexibility might be what's needed to get a dictator out of the palace and to liberate their citizens. In the best circumstances, the international community would have some leverage, and they'd only offer the outgoing tyrant a safe passage into exile, where they could then live out the rest of their days in house arrest. That would be more like the golden handcuffs. In other circumstances, the deal could be slightly more lenient, a bit more parachute-like. It would depend on the severity of the dictator's crimes, what was most likely to work, most likely to avoid bloodshed, and most likely to result in a peaceful transfer of power that made democracy possible. Now, before you start to think that I'm some sort of monster, let me just explain a bit more about why I believe this is the right approach. There are two things that are worth keeping in mind here. First, in my research, I crunched the numbers about what tends to happen to presidents who lose power in sub-Saharan Africa. And what I found was astonishing. Between 1960 and 2010, 43% of African presidents ended up jailed, exiled, or killed when they lost power. It was basically a coin flip. For many of them, that was the taste of cold, hard justice. They certainly deserved it. But let's think about this from a different perspective. How would you behave if you knew that you had a nearly 50-50 chance of something terrible happening to you if you lost your job? I'm pretty sure you'd do whatever you could to cling on to that job for as long as possible. In other words, because the costs of losing power are so enormous, it creates a really strong incentive to stay for as long as possible, to forestall the inevitable. And that's why pretty much none of them quit while they're ahead, turning over power peacefully. They know that once they're out of the palace, they're probably done for. So instead, they rig elections, they murder political opponents, and they use violence against their own people to instill fear in them. Unfortunately, that's the rational way to behave when it's impossible to imagine any sort of post-presidency future. That's why the golden handcuffs approach might actually work, because it provides a glimpse of that post-presidential future to them and lowers the stakes of losing power.
If you are going to try to negotiate these guys out of office, you've got to make a deal they're willing to accept. And if you want to be able to negotiate other guys out of office, you've got to demonstrate that you can keep the deal. If you agree to an election and you lose the election, you say, yes, I'm going to leave peacefully. And then the people tell you, we're going to lock you up and throw away the key. What do you expect? And the calculation that you make is it better to hold your nose because this one situation stinks, or that you wind up continuing to hold your nose because of the stench created by dead flesh and body bags? It's really no more complicated.
In one case in the early 1990s in Haiti, the U.S. government secretly agreed to pay $4,000 per month to provide a villa to the mother of a military dictator so long as he left office. Now, as an American taxpayer, that makes me sick. But on the other hand, how much money would a military intervention have cost to try to oust him? How many more lives would have been lost? How many more Haitians would have had to suffer under his prolonged rule if he didn't leave? I think it's pretty obvious that spending $48,000 a year to pay rent for a dictator's mom is a bargain compared to those costs. The second thing to keep in mind here is how long dictators can manage to hold their citizens hostage. Paul Biya in Cameroon came to power in 1975, back when the Bee Gees, Queen, and the Bay City Rollers were on the charts. He's been in charge for 46 years. Just behind him is Teodoro Obiang, the dictator of Equatorial Guinea, where Yahya Jammeh currently lives, who's been in power for 42 years. There are currently 18 countries where the president has been in charge for at least two decades, and almost all of them are dictatorships. And to deal with them, there are really only three options. Leave them alone and let them stay in power indefinitely. Intervene militarily to try to force them out. Or try to cut a deal that causes them to leave voluntarily. None of them are likely to lose power naturally, and they're almost certainly not going to let themselves get booted out at the ballot box, as Yahya Jammeh made crystal clear. So in a world of bad options, golden handcuffs just might be the best of a bad bunch. If you don't believe me, let's briefly consider another West African country where an offer to leave power was refused. In 2010, President Laurent Gbagbo, a former history professor who became the leader of Côte d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, refused to leave power even though his opponent was recognized as the victor in a closely contested election. Because he refused to step down, a bloody civil war broke out. I arrived in Côte d'Ivoire a few months after the fighting ended. There were still bullet holes visible in the brick and concrete facades of various government ministries. Scars from a conflict that had left more than 3,000 people dead. It all ended when Laurent Gbagbo ended up captured. Here's what it sounded like during that dramatic moment when he was detained by his opponent's militia. Gbagbo was transferred to the International Criminal Court to be prosecuted for war crimes. But eventually, he was released after a panel determined that there was insufficient evidence to prove that he had ordered any atrocities. Exactly the sort of outcome that Sheriff Bojang Jr. feared in the Gambia. Gbagbo, the despot who provoked a civil war, recently returned to Côte d'Ivoire as a free man. His victims won't exactly feel that justice has been done, and 3,000 of his fellow citizens aren't around to see it anyway, because they died in a fight over whether he would leave or not. So it raises the obvious question, could there have been a better way forward?
Well, Gbagbo would not have been one of our candidates under normal circumstances.
While Gbagbo was clinging to power, Charles Stith was working behind the scenes with a program that he created at Boston University, a center of presidential leadership that would give presidents the opportunity to have an academic posting after leaving office. It was intended as a sort of reward to leaders who governed well, not really as a way to entice bad leaders out of office. So Gbagbo wasn't exactly the kind of person they were looking for.
we received an inquiry to determine whether we could create something unique for him in order to facilitate a peaceful transition.
Based on reporting from the time, I'm quite confident in saying that it's highly likely that the inquiry that Ambassador Stith is referring to there was from Barack Obama's White House, which was looking for a way to peacefully defuse the crisis before war broke out.
We agreed that we would be willing to create something unique to facilitate that transition.
So they effectively got Gbagbo on the phone and made him an unusual offer. Since you were a history professor before you came president, they said, why not return to academia? Why not put the tweed back on and come live in Boston? All you have to do is accept the election results and leave, to give your country a fresh start. Unfortunately, Gbagbo refused.
I wasn't surprised when neither him nor his wife perceived that as an offer they couldn't refuse. It's a shame for a whole host of reasons. But what I do think is that we do need to look at creative and constructive ways to transition people out of power when they're at a point where they think it's either that, go to the mattresses and try to stay in office by any means necessary.
Two West African countries, two despots, two very different outcomes. In one, the despot was given an exit strategy. The country transitioned peacefully. It became a fragile democracy. And people began to taste freedom. In the other, the despot clung to power. A war broke out. Thousands died. And justice still wasn't served. Of course, for Yahya Jammeh's victims, what I'm suggesting here is tantamount to amnesty for someone who committed monstrous acts. But I guess my answer to them would be that I'm trying to just think of what would create fewer monstrous acts in the future, fewer victims like themselves. I'll admit it, it's a straight-up pragmatic utilitarian view that I believe would reduce suffering and prevent war and germinate some genuine democratic hope. Though I'm sure that's cold comfort to those victims. And Sheriff Bojang Jr. says, some people are understandably unable to move beyond their need for prosecution and their demand for justice.
I have friends whose faces were cut with bayonet. I have friends who are widowed today. I have friends who disappeared. I have a colleague, a dear friend, who disappeared many years and probably will never be found, was dead and buried, killed and buried somewhere. For them, for the victims, there must be justice. There is no issue of striking a balance. There must be justice. For people who disappeared, for people who were tortured, who went back to prison after the end of Jammeh, thinking that their relatives, their fathers and sons and husbands will be there, for them not to see anybody appearing from the prison, and for them to be told on that day that your father or your mother or your relative, they were killed 10 years ago. There is no issue of striking a balance between the interests of reconciliation and prosecution. There must be reconciliation.
Similarly, for Tutu Alicante, a lawyer and a human rights activist from Equatorial Guinea, the dictatorship where Jammeh ended up, by the way, what I'm proposing is beyond the pale. He wants justice against the dictator that has ruled his country for four decades, a man named Teodoro Obiang.
What Obiang has done, you know, is deny hundreds of thousands of people their basic humanity. That, to me, is the grossest form of human rights violation, of callousness, of inhumanity. When you deny of people their basic sense of humanity, there are many people in Equatorial Guinea today who have had their kids murdered in the street, who have had their loved ones disappeared, who believe they cannot say anything because they'll be next. So for someone to do that during 40 plus years and then to retire somewhere, I don't know, in Bahamas or Panama or, you know, Senegal or whatever, it flies in the face of anything that, you know, I believe in as a human rights activist. Personally, I have a tough time with that.
Moreover, Tutu quite reasonably points out that dictatorships might survive the loss of a dictator, because they've developed so many tentacles that won't just be cut off if they leave power.
What Obiang has done masterfully during these 42 years now in power is to build a complete system of nepotism, deeply entrenched nepotism, a complete system that revolves around him. So you have Obiang in the center and you have all these concentric circles where, you know, the next circle, if you think of an onion, the next layer, you know, is just basically Obiang's family members. And there you have not just ministers, but you also have all the generals in the army, and you have all the key people in the parliament and in the judicial system. And then you have a next layer of people of his political party. And then you have a next layer of members of the party who are wishy-washy. They're ran by one family that with one person gone, you have not enabled society, you know, to be born again, you know, as a new democratic institution or to have even the tools to fight that fight. All right. So it takes more than Obiang gone.
I completely take Tutu's point. In fact, he's right. Sometimes the golden handcuffs approach just won't work. And I included his point of view here precisely because there are real reasons to doubt it as a policy choice. But the question is this: are the alternatives better? I pressed Tutu on this point, and I asked him if he'd still feel that way if he knew that without a golden handcuffs approach, the dictator's family would rule his country for another four decades.
You're only asking tough questions, Brian. I like to think of myself, Brian, as someone that is pragmatic, right? And if Obiang was offered that option of, you know, look, you can leave and go and live, I don't know, in Marbella somewhere, and we can rebuild this nation. And most Equatorial Guineans were willing to go that route, I personally would be willing to say, you know, look, if most Equatorial Guineans think that this is what we have to do as a practical matter, so be it, right? Again, as human rights activists, as someone that's dedicated my life to ensuring that, you know, the rule of law means something, I have problems with that. Yet I understand that, you know, sometimes you do have to put the good of the country, the good of the majority ahead. And if that means Obiang leaves, his family members leave, and the rest of us can figure out how to rebuild, perhaps that's the best we can get.
Look, this entire episode leaves a bad taste in my mouth. The least bad option, though, is often the best that we can get when it comes to dealing with dictators. So you may not agree with me, and I fully acknowledge that I'm making this argument from a place of immense privilege, because I've never been victimized by one of these murderous tyrants. But hopefully, I've at least convinced you of two things. First, that there's actually a method to the madness of why despots and kingpins act like Icarus, until they crash and burn. And second, that sometimes it's at least worth considering whether seeking justice is always worth it, particularly if the end result is likely to be far more bloodshed, or whether it's sometimes worth swapping the steel handcuffs for golden ones and letting some very bad people get away with it. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. The next episode, The Invisible Hook, will be a two-part look at pirates old and new. From the behavioral economics behind the skull and crossbones flag to some absurd sting operations that netted pirate kingpins, you won't want to miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. And a special thanks to Nanfeng Lu, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.